So it was a warm afternoon, the first time Lori had me out to her place in Dripping Springs, back when we were first dating. And I reached out my hand to push open her driveway gate, and the hairs on the back of my neck stood straight up, and I froze. Running up the driveway, racing toward me, were two big dogs. Now, they weren't a surprise because you had told me about Cooper and Jake, but their size and their momentum and the way they were racing to greet me, actually charging is the accurate word, it sent me back. Actually, my heart felt like it was coming out of my chest. Nervous enough to be at your home the first time, but these two big dogs coming toward me, well, my hand froze just short of that gate, trembling. And my mind, well, my mind went back to childhood. Back when I was 3 or 4 years old and my sister was 10 or 11, we rode this sled down the hill in our neighborhood to the bottom of the hill, and the sled slowly stops in the deep snow. And Lynn lets off this giggle and rolls off in slow motion to make this huge snow angel in the neighbor's yard just before their dog pounced up and bit her through the lip. And that, I think, is where my fear of dogs first started. But then it was confirmed later when my little brother Dan put his thumb in a bowl that had dog food in it, and a dog standing there, still eating the food, still in the bowl, and started dragging it away from the dog. And the dog, of course, kind of lurched forward and lurched forward. We asked Danny about this afterwards, and he goes, it was the only way I could get that dog to chase me, to play with me. Well, as you can imagine, the dog got tired of playing before Danny did and traded dinner for Danny's hand, bit right into his hand. And my fear of dogs was confirmed, like stamped in me. Thought I might have outgrown it until the year 2000 over in the office at First Baptist Church, standing in the office of a church, when President-elect George Bush's bomb dog, Pawpaws, this big German shepherd, bit into my leg. The fear at the gate at Lori's house was real. I could taste the adrenaline. I could feel my heart beating. And inside, I must have stood there long enough because in my head, I'm starting to have this conversation. Mitchell, if you really like this girl, if you want this to be more than the last date, you have to face your fear at this gate. And then something remarkable happened. I've heard of this happening before to people, and I've read about it in scripture before, but it had never happened to me before. Outside of me, on this side, in this ear, I heard a voice, a familiar voice, as clear and as present to me as your voice, singing the Gloria or saying thanks be to God. I heard my uncle's voice, my mom's oldest brother, saying to me right here, my uncle who lives in Kansas City, 800 miles away. No way he was standing there, or was he there? Anyway, I heard this voice. Boy, if that dog's tail's a wagon, it's probably glad to see you. And out loud, I said, yeah, that's right. And so I looked to see what's happening in the biggest dog, Cooper's tail. It's doing this, like a windshield wiper blade stuck in high gear. And the other dog, like, what's going on? Jake, the other dog's tail had a bit of a curve to it when it wasn't moving. But if you watch this dog's tail, it looked more like an airplane propeller about to take off. It looked like it spun completely around. You think the back end of that dog's going to start going up. Well, the message is clear from the two dogs. And from my uncle, who's not there but somehow is there. And the fear begins to thaw a little bit, and my hand finally reached that gate, which was warm. And about that time, I saw you, Lori, step out on the back porch of the house with that warm smile. And she asked the dogs to relent their welcome. And it was much better immediately. I asked my uncle about it the next time I was in Kansas City, and he just laughed. I said, no, really, did you ever say that? I can't remember you ever saying those words to me. And he laughed again, but because that's his first reaction. He's just this joyful soul. He says, yeah, you remember y'all came over to the house every 4th of July. We'd shoot off fireworks. And Judy, our curly-haired dog, would snap at the firecrackers, which would send you to hopping. So I put my hand on your shoulder. And I said, look to the tail. If that dog's tail's wagging, he's probably glad to see you. And I tried to remember him saying that, and I couldn't. Now, I remembered his voice at Lori's gate in Dripping Springs, but I couldn't remember it in Kansas City or in the little suburb of Raytown where they live. It wasn't there. I tried to reach back. I tried to sketch it back into my memory, and I couldn't find it. And then he went on to say something that I will never forget, that kind of gelled this whole thing in my memory clear enough for me to write it down and keep it for, well, for today, for always. He said, you know, that's the same thing my daddy used to say to me when I was a kid. My daddy, your grandpa, which brought a tear to my eye because, well, I never met my mom's dad or his dad. Died before I got there, but somehow my grandpa, in my uncle's voice, was with me at that gate, as real as anyone has ever stood next to me and said anything next to me. And still, these days, if I am kind of coming to the gate with some peace about me and I put my hand out and that top bar is warm, I have this strange sense that I'm not there alone. And I think something like that is what happened to the disciples a little while after Jesus' ascension. On that first ascension day, Jesus led the disciples up to a mount called Olivet, just outside a town called Jerusalem, spoke to them for the last time, and disappeared into a cloud. We read about it here in the first chapter of Acts. One moment he's there with them, next moment, gone. His hand is raised in this final blessing, his face growing brighter and brighter as he grows less and less visible to us. Kind of vanishing into the fog, like the end of a dream too good to be true, slipping all of it out of their reach until he was no longer with them, no longer present to them, for them to touch in the same way, no longer present but past, a memory that would haunt them to the end of the days. According to tradition, where he went was to heaven, which I think may not necessarily be so much as up as beyond. And what he went there to do was to finish what he had begun with us here. It was not enough that through him, God was born into the body of the world. That's just his Christmas gift to us. His ascension gift is he takes us as in our bodies to God. Jesus takes us to God, which is a pretty wild thought, by presenting his own ruined, risen body to be seated at the right hand of God. Jesus imported flesh and blood to heaven. He paved the way for us so that when we get there later, well, they won't be so shocked by us when we're showing up. He restored goodness of creation and ours in particular. By ascending bodily into heaven, he showed us that flesh and blood are not bad, but good. Good enough for Jesus. Good enough for heaven. Good enough for God. Barbara Brown Taylor, who first preached this sermon, asked a friend about it, trying to explain this. She says, isn't this incredible? Don't you make this make ascension just come alive for you? And her friend says, well, it's interesting, but it's not compelling. Maybe what he meant was that it's still so abstract. It's apart from how we live, separate from every day in our life. Almost everything else that Jesus did in his life makes sense to us in terms of our own human life, right? He was born to a human mother, so were we. He ate and drank and slept, so do we. He loved people and got angry with people and forgave people, so have we. He wept, yep, got that one covered, don't we? And he died, and we'll die too. And then he rose from the dead. And I think we even know something about this. We each have our own Easter moments in our lives, joy found in the midst of sorrow, life in the midst of death, but ascending into heaven to be seated at the right hand of God. Well, that one's beyond my view, y'all, beyond my reach. Our view of ascension is from the ground, neck craned back, mouth open, sun blocked by that cloud who's taking our Lord away from us, taking our friend away. Luke ends his gospel by telling us that the disciples went back to Jerusalem with great joy. And I expect that's true. But you have to remember that it had just happened for them, you know? They'd just been with him, and the memory was fresh to them. They're still running on adrenaline, that bitter taste maybe still in their mouth. If they went away joyful, then I can't help but thinking it was because they thought that he'd be back in the next day or two, or maybe next week, at the latest, the week after. But here we sit, some 2,000 years later, And we tend to see the whole thing differently, don't we? A lot less expectantly than they did. Still waiting. Still watching the sky. Faces turned up like empty cups that only one presence can fill. But he's not present anymore. Not the way he used to be, if we're going to tell each other the truth, right? Ascension Day is the day the present Lord became absent, which may be why this is the most forgotten feast day of the year. Who wants to celebrate an absence? Who wants to celebrate the day Jesus went out of this world, never to be seen quite the same again? Yet here we are, hungry as we are for the presence of God. I think the one thing that we do not need is another day set aside to mark and to remind us of God's absence. Or is God's absence the very reason underneath all the other reasons that draw us through those doors into this room? Because we have sensed God's absence, haven't we? In our hollow nights, in our pounding hearts, in our unanswered prayers. And because those things haven't discouraged us from coming through those doors, but in fact, I believe maybe what brings us here, seeking the presence that we've been missing. Sometimes I think absence is underrated. It's not nothing, after all, it's something. It's a heightened awareness, or a sharpened appetite, or a finer perception. You know, when someone important to me is absent from me, I become clearer than ever what that person means to me. The details that get lost in our togetherness are recalled in our apartness, and their sudden clarity has a way of prying open wide my heart. The virtues that I have overlooked, the opportunities that I have missed, those crazy quirks that once drove me crazy at close range, well, they become endearing at a distance, don't they? And from that enlarged perspective, I can see that they are the very things that make my someone someone and not just anyone. Something else that happens during an absence: if the relationship is strong and true, the absent one has a weird way of being present to us, if not in body, then in mind and spirit. Barbara Brown Taylor tells this about her husband. Her husband, Edward, likes watching birds, especially big birds like hawks and the golden eagles, which are making a return to their corner of Georgia, that northwest corner. She says they'll be driving down the road, and if Edward spots a big bird, "What is that? Is that a hawk? Is that an eagle?" She should watch the road. What is it? "Oh, it's a turkey vulture." She says sometimes they drive past their destination so he can find out what that bird is. Drives her crazy, she says. Once in a while, he'll drop a tire off the side of the road. "Boom. Edward, watch the road! Watch the road! I'll buy you a bird," she says. "What's the big deal with these birds?" Drives her crazy. They were to spend a couple of months apart on a sabbatical. She was going one way, he's going his way. And she thinks, "Oh man, finally, I'm going to get a relief from these darn hawks." But you know, instead, she began to see those hawks everywhere. Looping, spiraling on rising thermals, hunkered down in the tops of trees. She says, "I began seeing them, really seeing them, for the very first time in my life. I understood that, well, I wasn't seeing them with my own eyes. I was seeing them with Edward's eyes. Edward wasn't there, so I'd see them for him. He was absent," she writes. Or, "Well, no, he wasn't absent. He was present in me," she says. Has that ever happened to you? I've heard some of you say cardinals remind you. Some of you spot a penny and remember a loved one. God shows up to us if our eyes are peeled. You know, there is no sense of absence where there has been no sense of presence. What makes absent hurt, what makes it ache, is the memory of what used to be there but is no longer there. Absence is the arm flung across the bed in the middle of the night where a beloved slept in the empty space. You cannot miss what you have never known, which makes our sense of absence and especially our sense of God's absence, the very best proof that you have known God once and could know God again. Can I say that again? You cannot miss what you have never known, which makes our sense of absence, and especially our sense of God's absence, the very best proof that we knew God once and that we may know God again. There is loss and absence, but there is also hope. Because what once happened to us can happen again, and only an empty cup can be filled. It's only when we pull that cup out, the empty cup out from hiding, when we own up to the emptiness inside us, the absent, the longing inside, it's only then that things can begin to change in us. It's our sense of God's absence, after all, that brings us here, I think, through those doors, seeking God's presence. Like a band of forlorn disciples, we return to this room again and again. It's the place we lost track of him. It's the last place we saw him, so it's the first place we go looking for him to come again, I think. And we've been coming here for a while now. But is absent, even though he is sometimes absent to us. It's good to recall these best moments and to argue about details and to swap these old stories until these stories revive in us again. The life flowing back into a numb limb. That hurts at first, pins and needles. And then the pain is gone. And soon the joy of our remembering brings balm to the pain. Hey, men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up in heaven? That's what the two men in white robes said to the disciple on that mount called Olivet, just outside of that town called Jerusalem. Luke calls them men in white robes anyway. I think he says so it doesn't scare us so much. But I think you can bet your last nickel they were angels. Angels sent to remind us, or to remind God's friends, us, that if they want to see him again, it's no use looking up. Better you should look around at each other, at the world, at the ordinary people in their ordinary lives, because that is most likely where we'll find him. Not the way we used to see him, but in the new way. Not in his body, but in our bodies. The risen, ascended Lord, who is no longer anywhere on earth, so that he can be everywhere instead. Not one of them standing around that day watching could have guessed what an astonishing thing had happened to them. On the surface, it didn't look like much, really. Not a great moment. 11 abandoned disciples with nothing to show for all that following. But in the days and in the years to come, it would become very apparent what had happened to them. With nothing but a promise and a prayer, those 11 people consented to be church, and nothing has ever been the same again, beginning with them. Followers became leaders. Listeners became preachers, converts became missionaries, the healed became healers. Now that is not probably how they wanted it to go down. They would have probably hung on to him and kept him chained down there if they could, because they liked him doing these things for him. Truth be told, it's what we want too. We would like for Jesus to be in this room with us right now so we could see and maybe pinch or hug and let him do it for us, right? Truth be told, I think that's what I'd like, but it's not what's best for us, I think. And it's not what happened. He went away. He was taken away, is what's written. And they stood looking up toward heaven, and then they stopped looking up toward heaven. And they got on with their business of being church. And you know, when they did that, surprising things began to happen to them and for them. They began to say things that sounded like him. And they began to do things that nobody, well, except for him, had ever done before. They became brave and capable and wise, and so will you. You will receive power. You will receive power. And whenever two or more of them got together, it was always as if there was someone else with them in the room, whom they couldn't see, who was available to them as wine and bread, and as familiar to them as their friends' faces who were around them. It was almost as if Jesus didn't ascend to heaven, but exploded. Really. All of that love of his that was once concentrated in this one human life exploded, sent everywhere, far and wide, like seeds of heaven being thrown all over the fields of the earth and in every life planted love beyond measure in your life and in my life and in the life of everyone we will ever meet, present in us the living love that knows no boundary. So did you come here today searching for God's presence? Look around. Look around.